You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. 25 years on, Florida's first serial killer, G.J. Schaefer, returns with a new expanded volume of illustrated killer fiction, featuring the stories used to convict him of double murder in 1973. The ex-cop and serial killer was doing two life sentences for the murder of two teenage girls when he himself murdered in 1995. Sandra London first published a collection of these stories in 1989, under the imprimatur of Media Queen. Feral House published killer fiction in 1997. Now comes the new expanded collection that also includes the story Schaefer wrote in prison for Sandra London. 73 illustrations include drawings by Schaefer seized by police in 1973 and used as evidence to convict him of murder, impressionistic sketches of Schaefer by Sandra London, and facsimiles of his handwritten statements. The book that we're featuring this evening is Beyond Killer Fiction, Rogue Cop, with my special guest, investigative journalist and author, Sandra London. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Sandra London.
I'm so pleased to talk to you, Dan. You're always such a good interviewer.
Oh, thank you so much. You are also the most fascinating and interesting and controversial guest a person can imagine to have, and I thank you for that. Let's talk about how you came to be involved with this book, Beyond Killer Fiction.
Mm-hmm. Where should I start?
Yes.
Should I start with meeting Schaefer?
Yeah, start with, obviously we have to, for those people that don't know that story, when you first met him when you were 17 and he was 18,
mm-hmm.
Tell us about that and what happened 9 years later and what happened 25 mm-hmm. years later.
Like everything.
Yes, yes.
All right. Well, we'll just take it one step at a time then, Dan. I was a kid. I went to Stranahan High in Fort Lauderdale, and I had a steady boyfriend for a year, and we went to a dance like we often did. And there was this handsome guy, never saw him before. The reason for that was he went to the St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic school. So
right.
He had a date, a girl who went to my school, and he was there. But he kept looking at me. And so there I stood there at the punch bowl, and he came up. It sounds kind of corny and cliche, but it did happen that way, and he came up and chatted me up, and he got my name, but not my phone number, and we both went back to our respective dates and continued the evening, but he went home, and he looked up in the phone book every name with that last name and called them until he found me. And so what I like to say about that is that was the first time I'd been pursued by a serial killer, but it wasn't going to be the last.
So you talk about this relationship, and despite what people might think for the reason for breaking up, what was the reason for breaking up, and what was characteristic of the relationship in terms of what he would have to offer in this relationship?
John was a good-looking, tall, 6'2", and he was physically fit. He had blonde hair, blue eyes. He had been very social before he dated me. His girlfriend was a socialite, and he was her escort to all the upper-class functions. The family belonged to the yacht club and the country club, and he was a Catholic boy, went to Catholic school, and did Mass every day, 7 days a week he went to Mass. And so he was an outdoorsman. He loved to go out. The family had a boat and loved to go out on the boat and go fishing and go hunting. His father and his brother also did. And we did a lot of normal things that kids do, dating, went to the dances and the football games and went to the beach. We were in Fort Lauderdale, so going to the beach is big. The thing that was a little different with John was all this outdoor stuff, which I never really, that was not part of my interest or anyone I ever knew, so that was new. And he would take me out in the Everglades and go hunting, or he took me out on a thing people might recognize called Whiskey Creek. In the beach, there's usually a little strip of water that's behind the sand. It's like a tidewater pool, but down there it's called Whiskey Creek. They used to use it for moonshine. Took me out there. We were supposed to be out there and come back, but the way I heard it was he got the information wrong about when the tide was out. So the tide went out and we couldn't come home. We stuck at Whiskey Creek in his boat, came home. That was a little stress over that. And I thought, you know, there was really nothing creepy about it. Nothing happened bad. But I think back and I just wonder, you know, that really there's something wrong with that, because he was so attuned to the outdoors, the weather. And knowing when the tide comes in is kind of basic. And the more I learned about John later, the more I began to look back on and examine what I went through, and I learned that John would test people, and he would find out what they were like, and then he would treat them accordingly. So it could be that that little interlude we had out on Whiskey Creek could have ended differently, but I was a good girl. I was a nice girl. I was a virgin. And unbeknownst to me, when we're getting to know each other and talking about, oh, I like this, I like that, or, you know, whatever people do in their meeting, that he was profiling me. And what he would say later was, I'd offer a girl $20 for a blowjob, and if she took it, she was dead meat. He had a complex, virgin whore complex. So I was what you called the virgin. So right. I was really safe from him, from the things that obsessed him. I didn't see them. And I think it's important to realize that a serial killer is not like a regular killer. He's able to rack up all those scores because he can pass for normal. And he can mix with people and not attract the kind of attention that we like to think that we can tell when someone's a wrong number, right? You'd like to say, oh, yeah, man, you know, I got a sense for people there that are off. And that's why serial killers are so rare. You know, people talk like that are talking about regular offenders, if you will, just plain disturbed people. But a serial killer masks that, and you don't see it. And so that set for me later, when I found out about his crimes 9 years later, it set up for me the mystery of how in the world I spent a year with this guy, and we were as close as can be. We were steady, boyfriend and girlfriend. Right. Knew him as well as you can know anyone. And at the same time, he had this whole other life going on. So that was the mystery that determined my going into this issue then in 1989 to really face it, to face up to it and try to get come to terms with the with my experience.
You were an accomplished writer, but you were a technical writer, and you
yep.
were looking and longing for something other than this technical writing to get your teeth into. So yeah. In 1989, you looked at the writing situation, I mean, the the reality of writing for yourself. Tell us about this correspondence, how you initiated this correspondence with Sheriff. Tell us a little bit about the first meeting.
So
and,
it was after 1988. So 1988, people who are into business know was a terrible year for business. I never knew that. I thought it was just me, okay? And I was smart, but I was not worldly. And I just thought I had always gone and pitched my services and got the job immediately. And then I spent that whole year. It wasn't happening. So I continually searching myself for what was I doing wrong and what could I do right. And in the midst of that, they executed Bundy. And I noticed on the media, everything was Bundy, 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 and everything was serial killers, serial killers. So I bought that book by Ann Rule and read it and said, And I did not think that she was that good of a writer. And I did not think from her story that she knew that fellow that well. And I said to myself, I can write better than that, number one. Number two, I knew a serial killer a lot more than she did, and maybe I'll write about that. So I looked up the police sheriffs and the Fort Lauderdale police, Broward County sheriffs. I called them. I said, "You got Gerard Schaefer down there in prison," and I was thinking of contacting him, but I wanted to find out. Did he ever kill that girl that lived by him, Lee Hayline? And the police looked, and they came back. Now, you see, that's not someone who knows anything, right? It's just someone who's sitting on a desk.
Sure.
So they go and they consult something, and they come back and they say, no, he did not kill anyone named Lee Hayline. Well, guess what? Right before he killed her, she'd married another guy, so they had her on the record as Bonadies, Lee Bonadies. But I didn't ask him if he killed Lee Bonadies. I asked him if he killed Lee Hayline, and they said no. And so I said, well, so that, all that talking he did to me about her, that was nothing. And I'm just going to go ahead and contact him. So I believe if I had confirmed that he was a suspect in the disappearance of Lee Hayline, that I would not have contacted him.
Interesting.
But I did.
Tell us about that first reconnection. It had been 25 years.
I know. It's terrible. So I wrote and I said, do you remember me? And I'm a writer now, and would you like to write a book about your life and crimes? And he wrote back, of course I remember you. How could I forget you? My love for you burned with a cold blue flame, and he was off to the races. So in answer to my question, oh, yes, very much, he would like to engage in any kind of project with me because he was still obsessed with me. He said, I loved you then, I love you now, and all this kind of stuff. So at any rate, looked like the deal was on. So we proceeded to exchange letters, and the working premise was I asked him, you know, when you got arrested, there were all those stories, and I said, do you still write that stuff? And he, well, yeah, and then it started a whole new deluge of this activity that Schaefer liked to engage in. Involving writing.
So
tell
us about
the stories he wrote for me.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe I should say at me.
At you.
He hurled them at me. Let me explain what I see going on here. It's a perversion that is analogous to lawyerism. Exhibitionism. And so he sits there and he creates this appalling, shocking, disgusting scenario that appeals to his perversions. And then he packs it up and he sends it to you, and then he sits there and just grins, thinking about how this is going to hit you, because it does hit you. The things that he wrote for me in that book are assaultive, palpably assaultive. Okay, now, it hurts to read it. I don't recommend this book. Let me say, start right off here. I don't recommend this book for anyone who is tenderhearted or anyone who just like me wants to have fun. You know, girls just want to have fun. Don't read this book. This is for people who are very serious about trying to learn about the pathology that creates these violent crimes. It occurs in the mind. And we have gone deeper in this book than anyone ever has. And I've had many people review this work and say that, not just me. I wouldn't dare say that, because how would I know? But since it's been out, there's been all kind of reviews where they have said it's more explicit, horrifying than Marquis de Sade, and there really isn't anything more depraved or explicit than this book. And so you have to understand what the nature of it is. And if you come to read this book, you have to know what you're doing, okay? This is not like a Disney ride where you get on and you, woo, woo, that's fun. This is the real thing. We're talking about the kind of minds that are still walking around. And that is the kind of things that they are thinking. And we don't like to hear it, but I agree with Schaefer. It was Schaefer's aesthetic that he taught me, and now I agree with him that it serves the public better to go with the disgusting, vile, explicit, repulsive, horrifying, true thinking. It's you are better served to know that than you are to read some Disneyfied version, because all that can do is titillate you and give you the wrong idea of what violence is all about. It makes it seem like recreational entertainment that anyone could participate in. By cleaning it up and expurgating it. And so I went the other way. I put everything in there that you don't want to hear. And I experienced a lot of trauma working on this project. I got over it by getting over it. I got through it. I did it. I closed the book. I went on with my life, and I got better. Now I'm deep into it again, and it's just like a psychological reenactment of a trauma, because I feel it again. I feel traumatized working on this now. So,
you talk about the trauma. And I can understand that. I can comprehend it. This is very hard to read. It's incredibly hard to read.
Yeah.
The thing is, you had the power to direct this book project.
Yep.
Why was it important for him, it seems, to direct this book project and its contents?
Oh, well, for him, I think he was acting under like an obsessive-compulsive type of a syndrome. And again, it's a perversion. It's just like exhibitionism. It's like, oh, she wants to know about my filthy mind? Well, look. Open up the trench coat and show you. Because you asked that you wanted to know, and we had a lot of arguments, and I'm going to be including them in my next volume. My next volume goes into the true story of Gerard John Schaefer. This volume is limited to the fiction that he wrote at one time or another. In the next one, I'm going to include some of the dialogues that we went through back and forth between writer and editor about what I would allow him to do. So there were limits drawn. There are things that he sent me that I refused to publish. And I'll just say briefly, because I don't like to dwell on it, he was obsessed with defecation. It's a very primitive and very regressive kind of a obsession, and disgusting. And I always explained to him that it's disgusting and that he can write about murder or anything, but when he starts going on and on and on about toilet functions, I'm just like, John, I'm not going to publish this. Okay, we don't want to read it. We are grown up. We're not interested in pee-pee, caca, okay? So you can be assured that what he actually wrote had a lot more of that in it.
Mm-hmm.
However,
yeah,
I did allow enough. We argued and fought so much that he got real canny, and he'd work it into the plot where it had to be in there, right? Because I say it's just gratuitous. You spent the first 5 pages of the story with them sitting in the bathroom and taking a poop, you know. And it's just infantile. We don't want to read it. Nobody does.
Well,
so that's what we went through in writing.
Now, normally you are a serious nonfiction writer.
Exactly.
And now with that, when you deal with these people that are self-aggrandizing and also prone to exaggeration and outright lies for various reasons, normally the journalist in you or any journalist would strive for some kind of baseline for honesty to establish that some of this stuff is honest. And but that's also complicated by the fact that some of these stories that are in this book were used to convict him of murder somehow.
Exactly.
Somehow.
Yeah, it really delves into that shadow world between what really happened and the ideas or the expressions coming out of this sick mind. And that is why when I went back, I didn't mean to make 2 new books. I meant to make 1 new book, but it's just too many pages, and it's just too much material. And when I worked with Schaefer during the time I worked with him on this original project, you know, I accumulated a huge, massive amount of data, and I could only put out 1 book, and I could only tolerate so much of this. And I was in a hurry to just get that book out and just get it off of my desk and out of my daily schedule so I didn't have to deal with it. So I put it out, 1 book full of stuff. I put out 1 book full of stuff. So all this other stuff. So now, given the study of Schaefer's mind, in this reciprocal arrangement, given that, next we move on to the next volume where we do examine what is on the record, and we go over exactly what he did claim and then what was actually found and what is supported by other evidence. And we came to the part where my little game with him, I provoked him. I kept telling him to write more, and oh, he was such a great writer, and let's see more. And really, it was hurting me so much, and it was so painful, and it was so difficult. But the tap was running, and I felt that this was valuable information, even if I was unable to analyze it as such at the time. I was able to get the information, so I kept it going as long as I could.
I see.
Collected as much as I could and try to use that to kind of work around it. So we getting into the spirit of all this, as things went on, here's something I haven't mentioned in this interview yet. Schaefer had 2 stories that he required me to maintain at all times, 2 opposite stories. He would go on and on and on about how he was an innocent, framed ex-cop who got framed because he knew about all the dope dealing in the high places. And he was just a creative writer, and he wrote really good creative writing that made people think it was real. That was one story. The other story was he was what he liked to quote the DA in the headlines saying that he was the greatest killer of women in this century, and he would say that, you know, I'm the greatest, you know, and you've got the real thing, you know, and oh, I've beat whores to a bloody pulp, you know, and he would go on and say all these affirmative statements about incriminating himself, literally. But then when I would, he would hear me saying that he was a serial killer, he would lose his mind and go into an absolute rage and want me killed and my daughter killed. Wow. And he'd file suit against me because he's not a serial killer. He filed suit against Colin Wilson, against Mike Newton, against Harold Schechter, against... Wow. I can't think of the other guy's name, but another true crime author, and everyone for calling him a serial killer. But he was also, you know, saying he was. So I collected, when he sued me, I collected 500 pages of his handwritten statements and made a document I call the 500 pages. And I attached that to my response to the lawsuit to bring it to the attention of the judge and say, this is what we're dealing with here, judge, and I need you to look over this. And this man has made all of these statements freely of his own will, and that's my response. And I refuse to be drawn, to be required to come to court where he is. You know, he wanted to come to court, you know, and I refuse to do that. But I need you to review this, Your Honor. Thank you. And Your Honor just threw it out, you know. That was that for that. Same 500 pages went to Mike Newton, and his court ruled and made very, very, poignant comments about, you know, these documents, these 500 pages. Now he proudly asserts his status as a serial murderer. So then when he sued Colin Wilson in England, the judge commented that he was libel proof. And so these comments by the judges made in the different cases were passed around and used to defeat him and his efforts. But he didn't care. He liked to be annoying. And he'd say, I may not win in court, but I'll sure break them going to defend themselves, you know. So that was the nature throughout the entire Schaefer experience, the two stories. When he, all right, I wrote this piece about him that and ran it off on one side of a piece of paper. He took that and he copied it and he sent it around to newspaper editors everywhere. So I'm talking about, is he a serial killer or is he framed up, which was his story. It was a question. Is he a framed cop, is what my question asks. He goes and he handwrites on these, this. Dear Your Name editor, you have 18 unsolved homicides in your jurisdiction. To find out more about what happened to these victims, contact Media Queen Sandra London. So he sent all these around to these people. And so this one, which was U.S. Today, he said he wanted to talk to me, so I came into his office. I sat there in his office in USA Today. And I'm saying, yeah, well, he says he's a framed cop and all of this. And then he pulls out that note. He says, you wrote this? Yes. He said, well, why did he write this stuff here? And he shows it to me. And I'm just like, well, there you have it. There you have it. He sends me out to tell the world he's a framed cop. Then he writes on it, I've got unsolved homicides I want to talk about. See?
Yeah.
So this is really, really madness, don't you see?
Yes.
And being dangled around like that for years, it really was traumatic, I must admit.
Yes. Sandra, let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Truebill. Do you know why free trials renew without your consent? It's a business scam out to get you. Don't let greedy corporations pocket your money. Download Truebill to take control of your subscriptions. Truebill is the new app that helps you identify and stop paying for subscriptions you don't need, want, or simply forgot about. On average, people save up to $720 a year with Truebill. Because companies make subscriptions hard to cancel, Truebill makes it incredibly simple. Just link your accounts and Truebill will cancel your unwanted subscriptions in one tap. And your Truebill concierge is there when you need them to cancel unwanted subscriptions so you don't have to. Truebill was easy to sign up for. I just signed up and they've saved me almost $100. I love Truebill and saving money, and you will too. Truebill has over 2 million users and helped save them over 100 million. Like Matthew B., who says, in a matter of seconds, I saved $660 for the year on my DirecTV bill, saved $120 for the year on my Sirius XM bill, saved $840 a year on car insurance. Don't fall for subscription scams. Start canceling today at Truebill.com/TrueMurder. Go right now, Truebill.com/TrueMurder. It could save you thousands a year. Now, Sandra, we were talking about that you had to fight this person that you were supposedly collaborating with to write this book for the purported purpose, of having him explore, maybe be some insights gained through his writings. And he is a good writer. And you talk about some of the training he had before you came on the scene and helped him as well, as any editor do, would shape a writer's writing and the story for the book.
John had a college degree, and he also minored in creative writing and studied under the novelist Harry Cruz, who wrote kind of harsh, unexpurgated type fiction himself.
Right. So when you came to write this project, or you knew that there were stories that he was convicted of, and there were stories that he used to write, that you encouraged him to write these stories, was there any direction? You talk about the arguments that you would have, not including so much stories about excrement and urine and his fascination with these subjects. But what was the guidance that you did employ in helping him craft this book? You edited this book, so tell us.
Okay. Well, let's give you a good example. There came the time when I challenged him and said that these characters he created were not realistic enough, that they were stick figures, and that he needed to go back and give them, you know, real personalities and let them become a person instead of just, a NPC, a non-playing character, just a stick. So I was urging him to do that. Well, here's what he did. Without telling me, he went behind my back and he assumed a identity of a 16-year-old girl that was a fictional character of his that he called Crystal Beavers. And in this persona he invented, she is on about people going to getting convicted of murder and not being executed promptly. And so she supposedly got this nonprofit called Justice Now, and she's agitating for all the people who are serving life, like John Schaefer, and people who are sitting on death row but haven't been killed yet, and advocate for hurry it up and kill them. All right, that is the character he invented. So what did he do then? He started writing letters to death row inmates in other states as Crystal. Hi, I'm Crystal. I represent Justice Now, and we want to see people like you brought to your execution. You're wasting the people's money and wasting
wow.
their life. And he's writing to people all over on death row as Crystal. Okay. So he picked on Virginia, and then I got informed about this by the authorities. And he had death row in Virginia in such an uproar. And that's how I met Joe O'Dell. O'Dell was like the hall monitor of the whole death row, the only one with any sense, and everyone brought every issue to him. And he was like the president of death row, right? So he writes, and he's like, this is terrible. Why is this justice, Crystal Beaver's doing this and everything, you know? I wrote to Joe Dell. I said, okay, look, there is no Crystal Beavers. This is a convict who is doing this to prove to me that his characters are more real than they should be. All right, so Joe Dell was like, what? Well, lo and behold, Joe O'Dell had done time in Florida at the same prison, and he knew Schaefer. Okay.
Wow.
Joe O'Dell was in prison, in Florida State Prison, when the warden was dealing dope. And Joe O'Dell helped bust the warden for the dope dealing ring. And they opened the doors of the prison and they said, go, leave Florida, don't come back. He had a 100-year sentence. They opened the door of the prison and they called it off and they said, don't come back to Florida. And so he fetched up in Virginia and got in trouble on murder. So then I dealt with him for about a year. He wrote a whole book, not a year, about more like 4 years. He wrote a whole book about Schaefer and me and harassing them on death row. This just goes on and on and on, Dan. It's not normal.
I can agree with you there.
How real is your character, you know? Who in the world would think of proving how good their character was by pulling a stunt like that? And he had the authorities in an uproar in Virginia, you know, and I tickled him to death. And I'm including the whole Crystal controversy in my next volume of, you know, the real stuff about Schaefer,
mm-hmm.
because that's what his madness really started. So what is real? What is real? We don't know about a lot of the murders, but we do know that is real. See? So that's a true story. So it all gets into the delving into the pathology of the mind here and goes in a lot of different directions, my friend. I'll tell you another one where when we first started working together, before we met in person in a visit, I wrote him a letter and where I said I was concerned because of the things that he had told me as a teenager, and then it kind of gave me pause, and I was concerned. And so when we got together in person, he asked me about that, and he said, what were you talking about, those things I told you that gave you concern? And so then I told him what he had told me. Would you like me to go ahead and tell you that now?
Yes.
All right, we were kids. And instead of going out to a party or a dance or having fun, he wanted to go down to the beach and hide under the blanket. I mean, usually when we took the blanket, we'd go on and lie down and make out, right? But
sure.
No, we sit in on the sand and we put the blanket over our heads. And then he cries and he goes to pieces and he's complaining about his life and all his problems. And you know, that's great. That's great. That's just great. And you know what? If I was 75 years old and a wise person, I might be interested in that. But I was 16 years old, and girls just want to have fun, my friend.
Yes.
It was a drag, okay, if you really want to know. That was what it was like to me. It was a drag, okay, and I was just rolling my eyes and wishing he'd shut up. And so he goes on, here's what he's telling me. He wants to kill women. And that there was a woman on his street. He lived on a cul-de-sac at the end, and she lived up where that little short road hit the regular road, right, at a T-bone.
Right.
That was on the corner. And I've been there many times. And so she liked to go in her backyard and sunbathe, okay? She would wear a bikini in her backyard sunbathing. That's the fact. As he related. Now he describes it in how that hit him. He is a virtuous, he's on a mountaintop of virtue, actually, where he lives, on this mountaintop of virtue. And he's just going out for a walk, and he sees this whore flaunting herself at him. All right, those are the words, okay?
Yeah.
This poor lady, she's just sitting in her own backyard minding her own business. She is not naked. She's just wearing a bathing suit like all the rest of us in Florida. She's just sitting in her yard. That's the facts. And then it triggers him into this whole whore thing. And the thing is that she's dragging him down off of his pinnacle of righteousness. You know, he would be such a righteous person if it just wasn't for these women flaunting themselves at him. They were trying to, you know, upset him and tempt him, whores, you know. So he told me he determined she needed to be punished. And so he found out when, well, of course he knew, obviously he didn't find out, when they ran the garbage on the street. That was a Tuesday. So on the Tuesday, he drove a station wagon. He said he took his station wagon, parked it right next to her house, wait for her to bring her trash out. And he had concrete blocks, and he had a blanket, and he had a rifle, and he had ropes, and he had knives, okay, in the back of the car. And his plan was when she came out to get the trash, that he would take the blanket and mob her with the blanket and, you know, wrap his arms around her in the blanket and throw her in the back of the car and get her down to the end of the street, which is where their boat was docked. At the end of the street, the street ended in a canal, okay, and that's where their boat stayed, in the water. So he'd muscle her down into the car, drive to the end of the street, put her in his boat, take her out to the Gulf Stream, shoot her, weight her, and sink her. And no one would ever know, okay? That is what he told me while we're sitting out on the beach. And why didn't he do it? Because his father came along in his car and drove up next to John and said, John, what are you doing?
Wow.
And John's, you know, oh, and so he canceled the mission because of that, because his father came along. So that was what he told me when we were kids. So now let's go back to our first meeting face-to-face in prison, where I told him that whole story. I said, that's what you told me. And he said, that's very interesting. And he said, because that's not what happened. I said, oh, okay. And so that's when he wrote the story, Gator Bait.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote it in a way that included his little motto. Excuse me, I have to cough. Sorry.
Let's use this as an opportunity just to stop for a second for these messages. Sorry, go ahead. You were talking about Schaefer and the things he was saying.
We were in prison, and we were talking, and I told him that's what he said, and he said that's not what happened. So then he wrote the story, Gator Bait. And the story Gatorbait is supposed to be what really happened to the lady on the corner. Okay?
Yes.
So I'll just leave it at that. That's what Gatorbait is. It's where he clarified that something really did happen, but it's not what he told me when we were teenagers.
Yes. What we haven't talked about is sort of the tone of his writing as well. And then very much like a lot of these serial killers,
grandiosity.
What they do is, yes, there's a grandiosity, but there's also a denigration of almost everybody involved. The police,
of course.
Everyone.
And there is no one who escapes it. Okay, so don't take sides. I mean, he wrote, I'm not gonna get into the whole language thing, okay? I don't believe in censorship, and I believe in using the words that people use. But I understand we're in a broadcast medium, and I don't want to start a whole backlash. So I'll just say the guy was black, okay? So when he wrote that story to me, it upset me so much. I took the story, I tore it up. First I scribbled all over it, and I wrote, "This is disgusting," and then I tore it in half. And then I put it back in the envelope and sent it back to him.
Wow.
But that was a turning point for me, because I always had to ask myself, even now, why should I get upset about the ugly way he talks about a black person when I've sat here for 2 years listening to the way he talks about every woman, every child, every man,
yeah,
every gay
that's right.
person.
Yeah,
And he even goes, he spends quite a while there when he gets into it on the Mideast, on the Arabs. He likes to go off on them too. Oh, God, and don't even mention the Jews. Look, I've got to tell you this part. This is how crazy he is and how crazy this whole project was. I had a girlfriend who was a lesbian, and she'd been in a relationship with another woman for 5 years. And the other woman dumped her for a skinny Jewish girl, okay? So I'm out with my friend, and we're talking, and she said, "You still writing to that crazy guy?" And I'm like, "Yeah, man, writing these stories." And she says, "Does he take requests?" And I'm like, "Well, I don't know, maybe. What do you want?" And she says, "Well, make one of them a skinny Jewish girl." I'm like, "Okay." So I mentioned it to him. I had no idea. Oh, God. It could be anyone. They could be Polish, French. I don't care. English. If whatever it was I requested, they would come out full of some kind of vile characterization. But it happened to be Jews. So there he goes off with all this anti-Semitic stuff, and then people will read this and say, "You know, this is not fun. Why do I have to read these insulting things about Jews? Why do I have to read this terrible thing where he calls black people old-fashioned names that we don't use anymore?" You know, and then you have to ask, "Well, how did you get this far in the book? What about the rest of the people he talked about? That was okay?" You see?
Mm-hmm.
You see? So reading it, it really makes you question your own reactions in that sense. There's no need in you cutting out a special exception that because a guy was black, he's supposed to write nicely about him. That's not going to happen. If he was fat, he'd write something about him being fat, right?
But what about,
I don't care what he
about...
was. It would turn it into something ugly.
But... he talks, well, at least Wilson talks about in your introduction about what Schaefer said his purpose was, and it seems uncharacteristically altruistic because he's a self-serving person. So he talks about this higher purpose of this literature, whereas you know, and you say, and it's pretty evident, he's getting off on shocking people. He's getting off on reliving some some things that happened and some things that are fantasies.
He's been prevented from perpetrating. He was a very athletic guy, remember. He was in the world. He wasn't an intellectual sitting in a hole. He was out doing stuff. So he's been prevented from his primary mode. So all the urges that he had are then translated into this abstract form of the same thing.
He talks about, though, in this book, and it's very interesting, the interaction with Bundy, and again, in this same idea that he talks about Bundy being so respectful, so fascinated with him, asking for advice. So there's this again, this grandeur that he is such an important person that everybody gives him, offers him this respect, including Ted Bundy.
Yep.
What about the idea
and this
that
is so untrue. He was one of the most reviled citizens of the prison. I mean, he was a cop. He killed underage girls. But on top of all that, I mean, I think we could have managed to tolerate that, but no one anywhere ever can tolerate a snitch. It will not be. It will not stand. You will not go in prison and be a snitch. Okay, so cop, killing girls, all this is no good. And then when they understand how much he's into, like, his perversions and stuff, that's disgusting, and they know it, you know. So, and before they murdered him with knives, they set his cell on fire 3 times. And they also attacked him with knives, failing to kill him, but wounding him severely, okay? And they would throw, you know, excrement and urine on him. So all this posing and posturing, trying to assign himself some spurious dignity, it comes from the lowest of the low, in the lowest social venue that exists, reviled among the lowest. You know, he had no respect at all.
You say that, and there are critics, but this is not for people that are still wrestling with basic lessons from how on earth could people do this. It's exploitive. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about the experienced. We're talking about the person that has been involved in true crime and reading true crime and has educated themselves and is a sophisticated reader. I would say I don't think I mentioned
that Schaefer had a degree in criminal justice, mm-hmm. and that he graduated from police academy. I don't think I mentioned that.
He's a very intelligent guy, and that's pretty evident. But it's also people will ask, even the mm-hmm. Even the person that's very experienced, is mm-hmm. this what you wanted? You talk about the trauma.
Oh, God, no. I wanted to write a normal book like Ann Rule. Mm-hmm. But I had so much material of this nature, it made a book. And then it was just, let me get out of here. So I'm like, this is what the book is. I'm out of here.
It's an informative book, though, that when you talk about...
It is. If that's what you want to learn about seriously, if you're serious about... It's a recreational entertainment kind of thing. They talk about serial killers. Ooh, serial killers, what are they really like? And, ooh, I want to know, and go into the mind of a serial killer. But when you get those other products that pretend to do that, it's not real, Dan.
That's right.
Okay, that you want to find out what's going on in the mind of a seriously disturbed human being who is capable of the most profound violations of God's creation, if you think you want to know, then you come to this book. Take as much as you can. But if you can't stand it, just close the book, because it definitely gets worse. As you're reading through it, it gets harder and harder and harder to absorb, because you just want it to be normal. You just want to make sense of it. But
it really does.
You're there to find out about real pathology.
It really does read, though, differently in the book in terms of some of the stories seem very realistic, very close to being actual.
They're realistic, all right.
Where other ones are, there's some elements of science fiction and fancy.
Oh, that's going into the rogue cop. Once you get to the rogue cop stories, they're satirical, and it's a send-up of all the media coverage that Schaefer had. And all do you know that Theory of Dreams by Sigmund Freud, he explains that when you have a dream, every character in the dream is some part of you. All right? So when you look at the rogue cop stories, every character in there is Schaefer. So he's got the cop. You know, the cop Schaefer tracking down the killer Schaefer in prison, you know. And so you can see it that way. But, yes, it is a completely different style, and he wrote it for a different kick. Got a different kind of kick out of it. But I started this book with the Stark stories, Expecting Dinner, and the other one that I've been persuaded not to mention. And I wanted to tell you something about those two stories. You know, I did that documentary with Errol Morris.
Mm-hmm.
And you know he's the number one documentary filmmaker in the world, right?
Right.
Errol Morris wanted to make a film out of those two stories, Early Release and the other one. And he told me that, and I said, oh, Errol, no. This stuff is just nasty. I said, I don't want to see you make a film about this stuff. And I turned him down.
It really is revealing the things that he does say and the things he focuses on. On one hand, he is a suave playboy seducing beautiful women. On the other hand, he turns the tables and then tells them who's boss, why they're boss, you have sinned. And he gets into this bizarre Catholicism where you have sinned, so you're a sinner because you're a prostitute, so I have to kill you, and I have no qualms with killing you. He forgets about what sins are, so his justification is very much like some of these people.
You know, Danny Rowling was religious, too, and I had asked either one of them one time or another, where was your God when you were killing?
Yeah.
You know, what's with all this religion stuff? Why didn't that make any difference to you when, you know, you urged to kill Cain, you know? But you have to remember about religion. A lot of people seek to come to religion because they know that they're desperately sinful in their heart. And they're trying to cope with it, trying to maybe find a way to control it. So when we think of church people, we generally think, oh, good people, nice people, law-abiding people that do the right thing. But remember that religions serve another purpose. Religions are there for sinners. And these are sinners.
Certainly. Yeah. Sandra, you talked about the book next, Beyond Killer Fiction, and totally opposed to this book, totally divergent from it. What is this next book? Tell us again about
Killer
the next project.
This will go into the whatever we know about his cases, and we know more now than we did before. And I was able to assist law enforcement in closing two murders post-mortem after we lost Schaefer. We were able to close two more murders, which was great. You know, and then some of the remains turned up that had not turned up when he died, which was Lee Hainline, the very one that I stood outside her window, and John told me that she would undress in front of him and that he was going to put a stop to that. And, honey, I will never forget that scene. I can see it now just like it happened 5 minutes ago. Because... he had an emotional mix that I'd never seen before, and I don't think I've ever seen it again. And that was a mix between arousal and anger, rage, really. It was really rage, but let's call it anger. And you would see that entwined, inextricably entwined. You know, I didn't know anything about him, murder, nothing. But it stopped me in my tracks, the emotional tone that he presented with when he talked to me about Lee. And it stood out. When he was out there on the beach crying and everything, he wanted to kill him. It was not the same thing. That was a sad, broken emotion. But this thing where he was standing out there talking about Lee was angry, and anger has energy, you know, so he was like it had energy coursing through him, talking about he was going to put a stop to that.
Yeah. It's incredible that, as I'll just repeat from earlier in the episode, that when you asked about Lee Hayline, or when you investigated about Lee Hayline, because of the former name, or her previous major, her previous name before she was married, that enabled you to be able to date Schaefer. Otherwise, you said you wouldn't have. And then now we come full circle where you...
No, not date him. Contact him to do a book.
Yes, yes. Yes, pardon me. But what I'm saying is that Lee Hayline factors into this story right in the very beginning.
Oh, she factors in, all right. You know, they were unable to bring charges on many of these cases. They didn't have enough. But look at here. They had a necklace engraved Lee, L-E-I-G-H, which is not a common spelling, all right?
No.
And it was identified by her brother, who I went to school with. He was in my class, Gary Hayline. Identified that necklace as being Lee's, okay?
Yeah.
Now, let me talk about my theory, if you don't mind, about the real story, or if you're not coming up for a break.
We got a couple minutes, yeah. Go ahead.
All right. My theory is this, that John has killed many people. All right, and that he was already studying and refining his theory of corpse disposal when he was 17 years old. Okay, that was what he would talk to me about. I'll put her out in the Everglades, and she'll be alligator meat by morning. That's what the Gatorade title's about, and that was one of his little slogans. He had another slogan that he said to me: "No body, no crime." And it was catchy. And he said that to the two girls that he abducted and kidnapped and trussed up. He said to them, "No body, no crime." And he had repeated that phrase, throughout his life several times. And he was saying that phrase at age 17, "No body, no crime." So I think that he gave enough thought to that he planned these murders he did down to the corpse disposal, and that he was smart and knew how to do corpse disposal. And what he told me then, the Everglades, and then he told me the, that current that goes down the East Coast. What's it called? The Gulf Stream. You get that body out in the Gulf Stream, and that's it. They take care of it right then and there. And so he had that all figured out. And then when he came along to this Jessup and Place murder, I'm really sorry to say this, but it doesn't match his MO. It doesn't really conform to anything about him. The crime scene had hundreds of pieces of quote-unquote evidence, things that they took into account. Not a single piece of it connected to him. Okay, there were cigarette butts. He doesn't smoke, okay? These bodies were hacked into quarters and kind of crude quarters, and they were thrown out in the sand on the beach nearby a hole. The hole was 2 feet by 2 feet by 4 feet. And it's in the sand. And they found it 3 months after John went to prison, went to jail. John was locked up.
Right.
And that hole shows no erosion. I mean, I don't know if you've ever built sandcastles.
Sure.
But this is sand. And the photograph of it shows it like it was carved last night.
Wow.
And the bodies were not in it, and it was not a grave. A grave is not 2 feet by 2 feet by 4 feet. And it called a grave. And then they had branches around, and they had marks in the branches. They never found a weapon that conformed to those marks. The ropes that were stuck, fringes of ropes stuck in the wood did not match any ropes that Schaefer had, of which he had quite a lot, but he didn't have any that matched. No forensics matched at all. There was nothing that placed him on that crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he got a fair trial. I would have appreciated, in the interest of American justice, if anyone get a fair trial. I don't really think he did that. Killed those girls. He wasn't. Those girls were not molested. And Schaefer's theory, which it sounded pretty good to me, is that they were cut up practically. So, and there was no crime scene. They weren't murdered there. There was no blood. The bodies were just dumped there next to this hole. No evidence of a murder having taken place there. So those girls were killed somewhere in some apartment or something, and they packed. Cut the pieces up and put them in suitcases, carried them out of there. It was not any kind of a sex fetishistic torture. There was not a sex torture. Those girls were not touched sexually. The lower half of the torso still had the jeans on, attached and zipped. And it just doesn't go with Schaefer's. So my theory is this. Maybe he did know something about all the dope dealing. The chief investigator on his case went to prison for dope dealing, okay? The criminal justice building where they have the jail and so forth is called the Rawlerson Building. Old man Rawlerson was hauled away to do big time for dope dealing, working with the local officials. So maybe Schaefer knew about wrongdoing in high places. Maybe when they started investigating his case, they learned about all these other cases that they could not bring. And they said, oh, my God, he's been running up and down, killing all these people. We can't even charge him. And we've got him on this. So how about let's just convict him, and that'll mm-hmm. be that. And
Sandra, this this is an opportunity to stop for these messages. Excuse me, Sandra, you were talking about, right in your theory, and you were summing it up about what you think he actually did and what he didn't do.
Yeah. Well, I think that law enforcement knew that he'd done a lot of things that they couldn't get him on. Okay, after they started putting things together, once they had him, and they knew he was a big creep, and they just wanted to shut him up. If he did know something about the dope dealing and everything, there's a better reason to shut him up. And to allow that inadequate trial to go, because there is no one who would say, this guy's an innocent, nice, you know, Boy Scout. Anyone who came in contact with him would be just shocked and disgusted at what they learned. And they'd be like, oh, my God, let's stop him. I don't know what you have to do to stop him. Just stop him.
How many
murders did... So they got him on these two, and I think they left it at that, and everybody was happy.
How many did they actually believe that they had semblance of evidence?
Some people might have believed some things. Some people might have wanted to pump up their own careers, right?
Sure.
By saying, oh, I brought down the mighty monster. And what mighty monster? Oh, he killed everybody in Florida. You know, you can see that, okay? So really, the kind of numbers that the state's attorney was bandying about have never been able to be supported. We can come up with about nine people that we're pretty sure he killed. The teeth were found in his possession. Their IDs, their birth certificates, for God's sake, their private diaries were found in his possession, okay? So we're pretty sure that he killed them. But I think there's people beyond that we don't know about. And he did travel in five continents, okay? And he was in Morocco, and he kept talking about the white slave trade and things that were going on internationally. And he put all that in his fiction, and he continued to try to talk to me, and I continued to blow him off because I just didn't want to hear it.
When
I learned more about Jeffrey Epstein and the kind of things that were going on, trading women to the Saudis and so forth, I said, oh, my God, you know, he might have really actually known something.
Mm-hmm. How informative was and accurate were some of the things that he talked about in terms of hooking a woman up to the bumper of the car so that he could raise her up and then lower her? So the very detailed and very graphic and horrifying things, how informative was that when you found out in relation to the actual murders?
Yeah. I can say that Robert Ressler's comment was, this is right in line with what happens in serial murder. He coined the phrase in his book, Whoever Fights Monsters. Robert Ressler describes how he formulated his theory of the modern serial killer based mostly on the case of Gerard John Schaefer.
Right.
He says, invariably, when I give presentations to law enforcement, someone raises their hand and says, you just got all that from the Schaefer case. And he said, well, that's not true, but I can go through my explanation of what the modern organized type serial killer is and use the Schaefer case to illustrate every salient point.
Wow. That's very interesting.
That's pretty high authority.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'll tell you how we got involved with Roy Hazelwood, the other expert in serial murder. And when I decided to do this project, I called the FBI. I said, I'm going to contact the serial killer, and I want a help. And so they referred me to Roy Hazelwood, and that's before the movie came out, Silence of the Lambs. So the behavioral science unit was not famous. Okay, so after it became famous, you could never get through or anything. But it wasn't famous. So I went. They referred me right straight to the top guy, Roy Hazelwood. He became my personal mentor. He mentored all this. So I knew, writing to Schaefer, knew that I was writing to Roy Hazelwood. And Roy Hazelwood is the author of a book, Autoerotic Asphyxiation. And that's where you use hanging type mechanisms to give yourself an orgasm.
Sure.
And he wrote a book called that, Autoerotic Asphyxiation. So Schaefer says, well, I'm the world's expert on this, and he doesn't know anything because only people he found were dead, and they failed. They didn't know how to do it, but I know how to do it. So I'll, with Media Queen's assistance, I will correspond with Roy Hazelwood, and I'll teach him what for about bless him with my wisdom about this. And so I'm going to be including the letters that went back and forth from Schaefer and Hazelwood in my fact book. And you'll see again that same shitty attitude, right, where he's talking to Roy Hazelwood like he's a puppy, you know, and extremely derogatory and disrespectful. So Roy entertained him shortly for a couple of letters, and then he's like, I don't have time for this, you know, this bullshit. So then hear what he did. I told you how he wrote to all these editors saying, contact Media Queen about homicide. So he did another little mail out. This was to every cop shop in the country. he sent one of these mail outs, and then he said, you know, unsolved homicides and stuff, and contact Sandra London, the close personal friend of Roy Hazelwood.
Okay.
He wrote to every law enforcement office. He, you know, seeing them, nothing else to do. He wrote to every cop shop in our country telling him that I had a thing going with Roy Hazelwood. And how did I find out? I got a call from Roy. Hi, I was, hi, Roy, you know, what's going on and everything, you know, and I hadn't heard from you, you know. And he said, well, guess what your boy's up to now?
Yeah.
Right? And he told me, and I was just horrified down to the soles of my feet and my little curling up toes. I was so disgusted and angry, and I was, Roy, I never told him anything like that. You know, but what can he think? I mean, I can say I never said that, but he doesn't know. For all he knows, I'm running around telling people that I'm his squeeze. Right? I never said anything like that. That was Schaefer. So that's the kind of stuff that he would do.
Incredible troublemaker, yes. Sandra.
Oh, he reported to the authorities that Danny Rowling was going to take me hostage and escape. And that's why they moved the hearing that I attended three times. I don't mean they moved it from one courtroom to another. I mean, you had to get in your car and drive.
Jeez.
Three different places. Danny was supposed to be in court. I came to report on it. And they moved that hearing three different times. And that's the one where he stood up and sang to me in court. That hearing was moved three times, and I had a reporter tell me why that was moved, because he had it from three sources that the authorities thought that Danny Rowling was going to take me hostage and escape. And they got it from Schaefer.
Jeez, unbelievable. It's unbelievable that he could spread all those lies and people would believe it for an instant.
Yeah.
And But his fictional writing, again, makes you question every single thing that you're reading. As fact or fiction or fantasy.
Yeah.
I want to thank you so much, Sandra, for coming on and talking about
it. Take it as a specimen of manipulation, as a specimen of thought, rather than something that refers to something that happens in the real world. This is a psychological phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Beyond Killer Fiction. It's just been released recently, this Beyond Killer Fiction, Rogue Cop. And we look forward to Killer
Beyond
Fact.
Killer Fiction, Killer Fact
and we'll
is
look
the
forward
next
to that.
Title.
For those people that might want to take a look.
Soon.
Yes. For people that might want to take a look at your other work, is there a website other than Amazon?
I have a website. It's called SandraLondon.com, SandraLondon.com. And I put samples of all of these different projects I've done on that website. There's plenty to read. And then I put links to shows like your podcast. So if you go down on a subject down at the bottom, you'll see the podcasts and videos that have been done on that case.
Yeah, well, that's great. Thank you so much, Sandra London, Beyond Killer Fiction. It's been fascinating, as usual. Thank you so much, Sandra London. You have a great evening. Thank you.
You too, Dan. Thanks.
Good night.
Bye.